So it's a rainy Thursday, November 16th, 2017, and coming up next, it's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, our two-hour Thursday evening show. Lots of flashbacks today and a few updates, but let's get into the show and we'll see what we will see.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
And welcome to this edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. It's a wet weather out there, but hopefully some of the folks outside, although apparently a reduced number, at least in San Lorenzo Park, which, again, I haven't been down there, but I've been told, both by the Good Times in yesterday's story and by the Santa Cruz Sentinel, perhaps a few days before that, that the city's Parks and Rec Authority have set up limited spaces in the park, sort of similar to the protest pens that were set up on Pacific Avenue, limiting the number of people who could perform. And at least there's no one-hour move-along law in the park, though we'll see when these folks are going to be told to move along. Also, to give credit to Police Chief Andy Mills and Parks and Rec Director Amaro Garcia, as well as City Manager, much maligned by me, and I think properly criticized, actually, in the past, and I'm pretty much sure in the present as well, but not for this particular thing, praised, in fact. People outside in the rain are presumably not going to be stopped from setting up tents, even if they're not in the park, against the weather. I'm assuming a human and if not sympathetic, at least humane response by city authorities, which may not be true because it's never really been true at all in the past. So we'll just see what happens with that as I talk to you from the dry confines of a roof and a nice apartment that I'm in myself. So I had hoped to get back to you with more from the sleep tight struggle for relocation funding and or decent housing, or at least continued housing, whether decent or indecent, for the sleep tight folks on Ocean Street, who are the subject of a supportive protest against the city's apparent dawdling on making sure that relocation money was available. And indeed, I'm hoping to actually play the interchange between the management and a tenant on Sunday, after the tenant has had a chance to respond further to the audio. I've talked about this endlessly and not really gotten to it. One of the problems is that one of the tenants has a real serious medical condition, and she was in the hospital today trying to deal with that. So who knows? The whole thing may be indefinitely delayed, but I hope not, because I think it's very telling and has to do with how tenants are treated in Santa Cruz, how they should not be treated, and also how people should resist that kind of treatment. I'm hoping to talk with activist David Silva, who attended fearlessly or patiently, or perhaps, he was at the last council meeting on Tuesday when I was not. I was able to see some of it on TV, or I guess it was computer, I guess it was TV, with the latter part of it, the oral communications period, and some of the discussion of the cannabis restrictions that the city is, in its, you know, continued reefer madness perspective, leveling on people using, selling, distributing, cultivating, trying to provide marijuana, both medical and recreational, in Santa Cruz. The issue that I'm interested in that I was not there for has to do with the kind of belated, somewhat, I don't want to necessarily call it tepid because I didn't see it, and hopefully I will get some more by getting a report from activist David Silva. I used to call him Dead On David often, and then sometimes when I wasn't so happy with him, Deadweight David, depending on my latest experiences with him in terms of where he was dealing with the same issues that, well, we're all trying to deal with, homeless civil rights issues. He's been a persistent fighter on those issues. We'll hope to get his report on the Crone Brown, those are two council members, attempts to get the code enforcement folks to come clean about what they're doing in terms of getting enforcing code violations that the tenants are reporting, getting demanding the landlords either fix them or provide relocation funding to tenants if they're evicting them. And that kind of was a substitute for a rent freeze. It was supposed to be happening on the 14th of November at the council meeting. I don't know if any of you heard the council meeting back in October, but Christopher Crone was, you know, insisting that there be some action on the 14th, and there wasn't any action on the October meeting, at least in terms of a vote, although Crone and Brown would probably have been voted down, but they would have made the statement, and they would have perhaps mobilized some more of the tenants and the students to come to the next meetings and to act more vigorously to address the issue. But, of course, it wasn't voted on because Crone succumbed to the, essentially it was the authoritarian dictate of Mayor Cynthia Chase, who simply moved on once the city attorney, Tony Condotti, said, well, you can't really put an emergency item on in this way, or you can, but it's a legislative decision, but it's not in my view an emergency. I mean, well, he doesn't have the problem of being out in the rain or probably being about to be evicted, I doubt, after his 25 years of dare I say, slavish service for the city attorney's office. I have to really... Tony's a nice guy, by the way, Tony Condotti. And I'm not saying this because it's sort of a way of saying he's an asshole, but he's really a nice guy. I don't think he's personally an asshole at all. And I have the same view about Martine Bernal, who I've been harshly critical of and will continue to be, probably. But I'm speaking about his policies in the city and also his attacks on homeless people as a sort of a lieutenant for former city attorney John Barisoni, and now he's moved up to be the head cheese or the chief buzzsaw against homeless people there. I'm hoping we can hear from David Silva about what happened with this code enforcement substitute item, which Sandy Brown talked about briefly on the air here a week ago when I ran into her in San Lorenzo Park. And by the way, she has not sent me anything that she's promised to do. And so I will have to begin commenting on that fact on the shows as they come up and as her silence lengthens, if it does. And we'll talk more about that as we proceed. What I'm trying to do is get members of the city council to, even though they haven't got a majority of votes and sometimes can't even get items on the agenda, they can still put in email requests to other city agencies and the staff who are the real powerhouse in the city, who create the real staff reports and recommendations to city council, and either do or don't enforce the codes or do or don't pay attention to tenants' complaints and so forth. I would say don't might be a more likely alternative, but I haven't looked over the records, though I did get those records to activists Cynthia Berger and Zav Hirschfield some months back, so maybe they'll have a report at some point. Zav's another person I'm going to be calling today because I believe there's some activist actions coming up in the next few days that he wanted to talk to me about, so let's see if I can get him on the phone. And so far, no luck. I just gave him a call and haven't gotten through. Let's see if we can get a hold of activist David Silva. Was able to get David. He's off to a medical appointment. But hi, David.
Hi. How are you, Robert?
I'm good. And I've already mentioned that you were at the city council meeting on Tuesday, keeping an eye on the code enforcement stuff. Any comments on that or other things that happened at the council meeting?
Well, like most council meetings, it's kind of like drudgery. You have to sit through, because some things that sound really innocuous that the city staff presents sometimes are really, really high-impact things on housing, homeless, you know, enforcement, sweeps, and so forth. It's amazing what the city staff can slip in a very innocuous, unnoticeable thing. If you asked them to give you a specific right now, I probably couldn't. But trust me, it's true. So this particular Tuesday, they spent a lot of time talking about density. So there's about three different items dealing with density, and one item dealing with marijuana tax. The marijuana tax, they did it illegally, so it's probably going to come back to bite them in the ass. The density, whatever the staff recommended, that's pretty much the way they went with. Fortunately, we do have Chris Krohn asking good questions and getting their response on the record, and you know, actually asking city staff, Sam, what are you up to with this? So he uses phrases like up to, and that's kind of like a little bit appeasing for those of us in the audience who are just like, oh man, what the hell is going on here?
You know, but regarding
I didn't go through the whole evening session. I just walked out.
I got you, David. Regarding density, we're talking about a whole attempted sort of four-story makeover of the downtown and the riverfront area. I mean, I don't know exactly. What's your sense of it?
It's they're using a low-income housing instead of establishing low-income housing in all neighborhoods. They're using this going around density so that they can actually end up creating a ghettoization process instead of a low-income distribution equally throughout the city. And I don't think we need to support ghettoization. It happens quite enough by itself already. But to have all our money and all our force and all our focus on what amounts in the long run to ghettoization, I think we really should stand up against that. If they want to have low-income housing, let's have some of these people in the west side, you know, turn over some of their property. Let's do something that's real. It's like it's so limp, liberal, you know, barely making it, getting anything done. It's pretty disgraceful. But, as far as I'm concerned, you know, we need to have a housing revolution.
Well, you know, we talked about this yesterday at the Huff meeting somewhat, and I guess my thought now is that this is a nice way of, you know, doing this low-income housing deal is a way of sort of, it's a sort of a little cherry that you throw in along with a massive...
With a massive
crap, which is essentially all this high-rise stuff downtown, in order to throw, you know, to push away the small businesses and bring in the high-rent stuff.
And these developers get to have all these exceptions. They don't have to have, it's only poor people. You don't have to have good quality standards of pipes. Don't have to. It's like they're like giving them all these passes on everything. So it really is fast ghettoization. When I read it before I went to the city council, I thought that's what it was about. But when I heard them giving all these dispensations and letting things go, you know, so that the developers just have free reign, you know, sure, all we have to do is trust the developers, Robert.
Indeedy. What about the code enforcement stuff? I've been concerned about that because that's what some tenant activists have been focusing on, is the failure of the city to provide relocation money to, and also to act upon, you know, when they've been red-tagging buildings, they're letting landlords get away with endless, you know, substandard housing, and simply the landlords will then just evict the tenants, and then suddenly the rental relocation money does not appear. Was any of that brought up at City Council while you were listening?
There were actual victims that was reporting that to City Council. I didn't hear much response and acknowledgement of that from City Council. And then one of the council members, I can't remember if it was Naroyan or Brown, had asked the city attorney about all this, or the city manager, I can't remember now. And there was a non-answer, but this there was brought up, so they should be aware of it. And it sounds to me like it really is a lot out of control, and all these measures to have things in control, like relocation funds and all this sort of stuff, really aren't working except for the landlords.
What about the fabled rent freeze that Krohn and Brown, you know, were shouting about, or should have been? The audience was shouting about it 3 weeks before.
Yeah.
Did they come back on the 14th? What happened with it?
Krohn mentioned that he was at a meeting the night before. I guess that was Monday night. He says where there were 50 Bernie people meeting, and they were all still very, very much concerned about rent control and rent freeze. And they seem to really understand, and quite wisely, that if you're going to go for rent control and there's a petition drive going, that you have to have the council help by giving a rent freeze. Otherwise, the amount of rent that could be hiked before the thing passes, especially if they're going to go by petition, which looks like what they're going to do.
Well, I thought that a lot of angry people in October were quite aware of that. In fact, they forced the city council to actually, you know, reply to some extent. And that, in the, but then Crone kind of, I think, screwed up with the city attorney and so forth. So he couldn't get a vote on the record. But I thought he promised he would do that on the 14th. And yet Crone did not put that on the agenda. Or let's put it this way. He did not direct the mayor to put it on the agenda. I'm told that any member of the council can get an item on the agenda, though I'm also told other things. What's your understanding about this?
Well, it seems like the 14th is some kind of mystical mystery date that so many things were promised. It was the date of broken promises, and that's just another one. Thanks for reminding me. Yes, I remember that quite clearly, and it didn't happen except people commenting from the audience. And there are people that are probably much better informed on this than me. I don't live down in the flats. I don't belong to a neighborhood association. We have a little group here where I live, but we just handle, immediate problems. But you probably should get somebody from those organizations to speak out, because they've done a lot of good thinking about it. It's just that, they're up against the city council that's refusing to do things that really probably the board of supervisors would probably do better anyway. So it's always that same thing. It's like people feel like they're being run around in circles, and they are.
Well, let me ask you, David, you've been living downtown now along Pacific Avenue for some time. How do I don't know if you have much contact with your fellow residents, but how do they feel about this densification, about the whole rental situation? Is there any chance of any kind of tenant organizing in your building, for instance? Or perhaps asking you.
And some of them watched the city council meetings, and they were very, very much offended by Rochelle Noyens referring to how ugly Front Street was. Give us a break, So I think that's got people more aroused than any of the actual facts. But there is a lot of talk right now, and I've been for a year and a half trying to get people interested in the city council, and it seems now that they do actually watch city council, and there's more talk. I don't know if we're the best place to start any kind of movement. I think that we're a good place to come and get extra volunteers when something actually starts happening. But we need to start mobilizing this the city council we have. If we got two more like Chris Cohen and Sandy Brown, I'm still not sure, since everything the city council does is like fed to them by the city staff. It's the city staff that is doing all this.
Now I agree with you completely there, David. But I'm wondering, you also, as a man who's downtown, although your mobility can be limited, you somehow, get to the Huff meetings quite regularly, and I commend you for that, although you sometimes leave somewhat abruptly, but that can happen too. What's a good Huff meeting without us having
a diaper incident?
A spirited discussion followed by an angry response. We get pissed with each other at these meetings, and that happens, and that's just how it is.
Well, you're not supposed to have your phone on during the meeting,
Oh, well, I don't have a phone, so that's no problem for me, but... But I know for others, that's how it is. But
obviously,
yes. So you keep an eye. You have some sense of what's going on the streets, and you may even occasionally make it over to San Lorenzo Park. Have you been over in that way and seen what's happening?
No, I haven't been to San Lorenzo Park much. I was going to the post office a lot when the encampments were there along the post office, and of course, Front Street here, my end of Front Street here. There are several different people that take different spots each night. And so I've gotten to know some of them, but as far as walking, it's so easy for me to go down there, and I just haven't. And I've made it a point to do that real soon, but not yet.
How do you feel about it as a guy who's somewhat physically disabled, sometimes uses a walker, maybe even regularly, I'm not sure how often you do.
Yeah, all the time now.
And there's all this, these drug dealers, needle users, and violent weirdos are hanging out in the park. What's your feeling about that as a man who lives nearby? And, you're over 70, so.
I would say that, that is a something that we should really, really all realize is bullshit. Bullshit. The people that I know that have been down the river are people that I feel like I could trust. Yes, there's a lot of desperate people within the homeless community, no matter what where they're at. I don't think that the fact that they were finally told, after being run around and run around and run around from this point to this place to this place, the police finally just started saying just the river, and then the community started being upset. Too late. You know, they're getting a break from being run around. And as far as I'm concerned, this thing of just having a 24-hour break and then they were allowed to come back, I didn't see them coming back much. You run people off a piece of property, they're not all likely to come back that fast. And so there's this theory that the police and everybody had that, oh, we're just cleaning it up for 24 hours, but they'll be able to come back freely. That hasn't happened. And there's a lot of neighbors that I know towards that south end of the other side of the park that are coming in and complaining and yelling. So I've heard mixed results. But from what I could tell, it was working really well. And this 24-hour cleanup just disrupted it. And I don't know, I haven't seen it lately, so I don't know if it's reassembled. Have you been there lately?
Last time I was there was last Saturday, and I think, actually no, it was last Thursday. And that was a week ago.
Yeah.
And also, you know, they're planning, according to yesterday's Good Times story, to do it again in 2 weeks. So I think it's they're trying to make sure people don't get too comfortable in the park.
Yeah.
You know, or possibly, I think Mauro Garcia may have said, folks are hoarding. We don't want them hoarding their property, unlike those, you know, prudent and cost-conscious middle-class people who don't leave any trash from their own apartments, of course, as we know.
Well, perhaps we could conspire here on the radio now to, like, have a bunch of us just make up these little paper keys and put addresses on them and let people, homeless people, know that they have that paper key, they have the right to go sleep on the porch of that house, and have them all go to the west side for a while and see how they like people being on the front porch instead of crying about people being on the front porch. People don't sleep on people's front porches. That's so much bullshit. But you know, they're always crying about the homeless sleeping on their going through their front yard. That's bullshit.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In Fresno, when there was this financial settlement about 10 years ago, and then the city began kind of welching on the enforcement stuff, and they would store property in wretched conditions that would destroy the property, somewhat similar to what other cities are using, other kind of punitive tactics.
Robert?
Yes, you got to go?
I have a pre-op to go to real quick here.
I'm going to let you go, and thank you, David, and we'll get back to you again.
We'll get it over again.
Thanks, man. That was, of course, David Silva, who has been working on this issue, as far as I know, since 1996 when he ran for city council. He was thrown into a concrete pier by Sergeant Andy Crane when he was trying to deliver petitions to the city council, and there was a simultaneous protest going on by a group of other folks who chained themselves to the fixtures of city council demanding an end to the sleeping ban. And looks like 20 years later, or 21 years later, their actions have had consequences. Finally, you seem to have to pound sense into the minds of these folks, and then they'll only take it from authoritarian figures like a police chief or, and I guess through the police chief, through the city manager, and then the head of Parks and Rec. The new policy, of course, supposedly, is for the moment, being allowing people to put up tents in wet weather, not harassing them for sleeping at night if they're not violating other laws, provided they aren't engaging in trespass on private property, but they're on public property. And also that means also not patrolling the parks with an eye to essentially gunning for, in the sense of gunning for with a ticket book, homeless people, as they were doing endlessly in the Poganip and the other parks and at City Hall and at the library over the last few years. A particular tip of the hat to activists Gloria Rave and Laura Tucker. Tough Love Tucker, we used to call her. She was a secretary for the Homeless Issues Task Force. Still, you know, low-income person still struggling along, who came down to help me review the Parks and Rec citations that have been gathering moss in the city council offices, where I'm trying to determine what the breakdown is by race. And what I'm really finding is I can't possibly know, because Parks and Rec rangers aren't writing in the race, or at least they aren't checking the box or the race code, so you don't know if there's lots of discrimination going on or no discrimination, as we found, for example, was the case with police officer Barnett downtown about 4 or 5 years ago in the on the Pacific Avenue beat. Blacks seem to be getting unusual focus of citations from him. And there does seem to be, as Mauro Garcia told me in the one phone call I've ever had with him, that there was very few stay-away orders given by the police beyond the 1 day, 24-hour stay-away, which is now 72 hours, thanks to David Tarasas and his Beat the Homeless into the Bushes City Council. So that's interesting so far. Again, we've got more work to do, and I've got to look at the police department's stats. And I'm doing a pretty sort of elliptical scan along, but not get into a lot of the details job on these tickets, because I just, frankly, lack the energy, the support, and to some extent the motivation. But trying to do a little bit and doing what I can around that issue. Take a media comical break with a Randy Rainbow song parody, Dhaka Shame. Listen on.
Welcome back. I'm joined by my guest, Presidential Advisor Kellyanne Conway. Kellyanne, great to have you. I haven't seen you in a while. But then again, I haven't stood in my bathroom with the lights off and said your name 3 times into my mirror. Casey, let's talk about the future of DACA, which for those viewers who are not familiar stands for Donald's a Cold-Hearted Ass Face.
Well, a few things on DACA. The Congress had all year to act. A legislative fix or some clarity would be helpful.
If the president decides to end the policy, it could potentially sabotage the futures of many hardworking dreamers, as well as deport close to 1 million undocumented immigrants, not to mention the devastating toll it would take on my sex life.
The president has expressed sympathy for many of the so-called dreamers. They refer to themselves as dreamers.
Kellyanne, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we are about to go to a live feed from inside the hollow tree where Jeff Sessions makes the cookies. Let's see what she has to say.
Good morning. I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
And there you have it. Kellyanne, when Donald Trump was elected, he said that he had a big heart and that anyone vulnerable to a change of this nature should rest easy. What the hell happened to that crap?
Well, that's what leaders do, though. Leaders listen to many different insights and inputs and contrasting opinions. The president surrounds himself with people of that nature. But at the same time, I want to remind you, he has never backed down from the fact that this is a country, it's a nation.
DACA shame, Donald. DACA shame. Thank you for all the stress and strain. Can't you be half as generous as you've been with the KKK and white supremacists? DACA shame, put them on a plane back to from whence they never came. Can you sleep at night knowing like you do nothing you do is right? DACA shame, a DACA shame. Hey, how you doing? Go yourself, darling. DACA shame, you for causing so much pain. Just behold all the lies you've told and this anarchy caused by your cowardly DACA shame. DACA shame, you've got a little bit of DACA shame. And hey girl, you should feel the same. Shut your face, you're a big disgrace. Stop your slandering, pandering to your face. DACA shame, DACA shame. Shame, DACA shame.
have a big heart.
Go back to Queen.
And that was Randy Rainbow's satirical take on the Trump administration's rejection of DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The number was called DACA Shame. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals was an American immigration policy that allowed some individuals who entered the country as minors and had either entered or remained in the country illegally to receive a renewable 2-year period of deferred action from deportation to be eligible for a work permit. I tried to get through to Mike Rhodes of Fresno because there's a protest coming up tomorrow in Fresno. And of course, I don't expect people to be listening to this in Fresno, but you never can tell. I think I've gotten a listener or two who's called in from there, a former free radio broadcaster, a DJ is, and a musician and composer is in Fresno. Here's the statement about Trans People and Allies Unite Against the Homeless Ban coming up Friday, November 17th, tomorrow, 4:30 to 5:30 at Fresno City Hall, located at 2600 Fresno Street in Fresno, California. Here's what they write. The following information is from the organizers, and this is on the Central Valley Indie Bay. If you go to indiebay.org/Central Valley. We need your visible support at Trans Emotions' upcoming rally on Friday, November 17th. As you may know, it's a community benefit organization, our Trans Emotion, that works to improve the lives of transgender people through support, education, and advocacy in the Fresno area. We are rallying and protesting the staggering number of murders and suicides of transgender people annually, including local transgender residents. We're also protesting the recent no camping ordinance passed by the Fresno City Council as it further criminalizes Fresno's homeless population, which includes a considerable cross-section of the LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. Gee, wonder why I've never seen this happening much in Santa Cruz, probably because of the class division here in Santa Cruz. It's all very well to engage in identity politics if you have the cash, but, you know, if you haven't got the status and the cash, well, don't want to deal with those grubby outdoor homeless folks, whether you're a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Peace and Freedom, or Green Party person. That's my cynical concern. Continuing with this story about the Fresno protest, pursuant of many local conservative views, this anti-camping ordinance generates a social climate of stigmatizing homeless individuals, dehumanizing the poor, and offers no real solutions for homelessness in Fresno. The local lesbian, gay, bisexual, and especially the transgender community already experiences barriers when it comes to social mobility, lack of access to employment, adequate health care, housing. Furthermore, the LGBT community intersects with so many other demographics, whether it be from a varied set of race and ethnicity, level of ability, veterans, school staff and faculty, students, persons with mental illness, and undocumented individuals, to name a few. This means LGBT folks are interconnected with so many other communities the council claims to serve. In the past, our organization, Trans Emotion, has asked the council for proclamations for our two annual events, the Transgender Day of Visibility, March 31st, and the Transgender Day of Remembrance, November 20th. We asked for the recognition of 2 days that are essential for our community. During this protest, we ask for no such recognition. We no longer need the trappings of pinkwashing and tokenism recognition that has been their support in the last 5 years. We need more than for them to all just say to us they stand in support. We need tangible solutions to institutional discrimination, and we invite you to ask for this with us. We will not ask for recognition. We will be there to state our grievances, and we need your support in numbers to help us. During the Fresno City Council meeting in which the ordinance was being decided, that's the no camping ordinance, on several representatives of the community decided on. Several representatives of the community spoke against the ordinance, citing logistical roadblocks as well as how the ordinance hurts the community, not helps it. Several organizations spoke, including ours, and we were not heard. Now we are asking you and your organization to join us as we make our pitch a little louder through this protest. It is our hope that stating our grievances in a public forum will reach the ears of the council, media, and entire community. Our demands will include having a liaison between the LGBT community and the council and the creation of accessible shelters that are inclusive for all communities. We hope you can join us in this effort. Your attendance is your support. And there's a very colorful flyer included: trans rally and protest. Join us as we advocate for transgender rights and safety while we're also protesting the recent no camping ordinance passed by the Fresno City Council. Play a little bit from the Fresno homeless activists program Street Talk. I tried to get through to Michael Rhodes, couldn't do it. He's an activist who's written a book about the whole history of his involvement with the homeless struggle in Fresno, the homeless civil rights struggle and shelter struggle. This is, well, hopefully going to be something that will be educational, even though we can't get a big mic on the line.
Hi, and welcome to Homeless in Fresno. This is Dez, your host today. We're out in the streets right now. One of our local street family members, and he actually was the first one to get arrested on this no camping ban law. Yep. And can you tell us, explain to us from the beginning what had happened when they walked up on you?
Well, first they came and parked the cars right here. Three of them, they stayed for about a half hour, before 5 minutes, and they kept talking to me, calling me, talking to me. And then he was getting real smart. And he just getting real mean to me. So I told him we're talking to him. And the next thing you know, he came out and he just arrested me and started taking all my things.
Now, did they do the proper procedure? Did they ask you if you wanted help, if you wanted to go to the shelter, or if you wanted to be arrested?
No, they were going to arrest me. They knew that one. I've been working with Matt for just a while now, and it just hasn't worked out yet with Matt and getting a place. So, he just said, he's going to arrest me. So he took me in the back of the car and started smashing all my stuff. And he put it straight into a garbage truck and smashed it.
Okay, now you're saying they smashed all your bicycles, because you would fix bicycles out here, correct?
I fix bicycles too. I give, you know, they need help, they need work, do work, I give them a bicycle and I'd help. You know, that's basically what I did. It cost me money to do it, but you know, I just helped people out. And so he didn't like that. Because the more people come here and help them out, the more people, I guess, have to deal with.
Tell everybody about what you do with the bikes out here.
The bikes, I just taking people to bring stuff. I buy things for everybody there, and I buy tubes. And I send people who need to go to work, and I fix the bike, give them a bike. I don't give people a bike just because they want it. I give them a bike because they need it. A lot of people want a bike because they need it. Yeah, take them back and forth to work. And it's easier when someone has a bike to get around. Now, you can't afford a car these days. You can't afford, if you're homeless, you usually can't afford a car.
Right.
And the bus costs $1.25, $2.50 a day. That much is a lot of money out here.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to hear Jerry Mulford. You can do this more easily if you tune to YouTube, because you can actually see him being interviewed by Dez of this show, Street Talk. So I'm going to kind of leave it there. I'd hoped that it was more intelligible. And it seemed more intelligible, but that probably was because I was looking at it at the same time as I was listening to it. So we'll wait on that interview. You can go to check it out by going to YouTube and just browse for Jerry Mulford interview. So I looked around a bit on YouTube in search of something from Fresno that is better and easier to hear, and I haven't been able to find something that really satisfies me. So I'm going to play a couple of things that showed up and also read a few articles. And then I'm going to play a relatively long, it lasts about an hour, protest, which does have audible audio from a Salinas rally that happened about a week ago. So that's what's coming up. Let's begin with something that's called No, You Can't See My ID, Officer. If you go to YouTube and write that in, No, You Can't See My ID, Officer, you'll actually get to see the video, though the audio is also interesting to hear.
I need your ID now. I don't have any ID to show you.
Sir, we're going to arrest you for concealing identity.
You have an ID on you?
Is that,
I'm protecting myself.
Am I being detained right now?
I'm protecting myself.
Actually filming down back there in our private parking area.
Okay, is that a crime?
It is right now. Do you have your ID?
No, it's not a crime right now. Okay.
And these are all sort of different clips of people essentially denying the police the right to see an ID, which they don't have, unless you are actually being accused of a crime and being cited for a crime. Although the ACLU does recommend that you show your ID with ID and address if you want to avoid having the police regard you as uppity, there are others who believe that it's important to kind of draw the line at that point. I'm pretty much in the that category.
Can you grab your ID for me, please?
No. Am I being detained for a crime?
Dispatch. Could be out with a party.
Me? For what?
So I can figure out what's going on?
That's not a crime.
Okay, why don't you grab your ID for me?
No.
You're refusing an ID?
Why don't you tell me what crime I'm committing?
Okay, right now, you're a suspicious party.
That's not a crime.
It is a party right now. I'm trying to figure out what's going on.
It's not a crime.
Okay, why don't you grab your ID for me so I can identify you?
No.
You're refusing to be ID'd right now?
That's correct.
Okay, sit tight for just a second. Suspicious party right now, so I'm just stopping to speak to you. Well, I'm trying to determine who you are, why you're filming the back area of the police department. That's all I'm doing.
Okay, well.
You're refusing to be ID'd right now. You're not going to supply your identification.
I'm not going to consent to anything.
Okay, I'm not asking you to consent. I'm asking you for your ID so I can verify.
Well, my answer is no.
Okay.
You're asking me for it, I'm telling you no.
Sit tight for just a second, that's great.
Okay, what crime are you detaining me for?
You're a suspicious party right now.
Because you need reasonable suspicion that I'm committing a crime.
Right.
What crime?
You're a suspicious party right now, wandering around.
Okay.
Filming a city building.
That's fine that you think I'm suspicious, but what crime do you suspect me of?
Now, it's interesting here, if you listen to this, and I don't know exactly where this is, that it's a police officer that's being videoed at the same time as you're hearing the audio. You notice as the police officer keeps repeating the same thing mechanically, and one has the sense that he's been trained to do this. Perhaps he practiced it over and over again. And indeed, I don't have any information about the inner trainings of police officers, but I've always advised people who are trying to deal with what essentially is the intimidating aspect often of police officers making a demand that they don't have any right to enforce. But if they keep pressing you, you may decide just to grant them their way because of a sense of apprehension, a sense of weariness, whatever it is. What you need to resist that is sort of a training on your own part to remain cool, to have your own response, to encourage people to come over and witness what's going on because you want to be essentially allowed to go on your way. The kind of the classic approach to this that Know Your Rights advocates, some of them in Santa Cruz, have advised is when you're stopped by a police officer, you say, "Am I free to go?" And if they say, "Well, we'd like to do this. We'd like to," you say, "Well, thank you. I'll be on my way then." And then slowly begin to leave. And if they say, "Well, you can't go," you say, "Oh, am I under arrest?" And they'll say, "Oh, no, you're just being detained." And say, "Good. Well, what's your cause for detaining me?" And it says, "Well, you're a suspicious character stuff. Not sufficient. They have to give you some reasonable specifics about their suspicion." And this guy apparently is being detained because he's, if the audio is correct, and well, the police officer's observation is correct, he's filming a police building, which he has a perfect right to do. It's a public area. And the fact that that makes a particular police officer suspicious really is his problem. Perhaps he should consult the local police psychiatrist. I don't know. Anyway, let's hear some more. It's interesting, and perhaps it can give people some insight as to how they might want to respond if a police officer asks them for ID and they don't want to give it.
Committing.
Okay, I just explained to you. You can continue to talk.
That's not a crime. You told me it's not a crime.
I told you that you're a suspicious party who's walking around.
But not.
Okay. Do you have identification on you? Are you a resident of Middletown?
So you're hired by the apartment complex?
No, I live here. I volunteered to do it because we've had many break-ins, so.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't have to show you this time. But I'd like to see. I'm not going to show you. I'm not under suspicion of anything, and I haven't been in trouble for anything. I'm just minding my own business. So I'm going to go ahead and record you this time.
Okay. Do you have any identification?
Well, I don't have to show you any identification. So.
Just like the idea, so I know who you are.
No, I don't think I'll show it to you.
Why not?
So I'm not required to, and
I don't really. Difficult or what?
No. I don't think that I need to be stopped for doing something that's totally legal and I'm not causing any problems.
Do you understand why we're talking to you?
One sec.
Okay. Do you have ID on you?
No.
So you're riding around...
Turn the vehicle off.
I'm sorry, but I'm not following any of your orders. You don't order me around. I am not under your command.
Sir, you need to identify yourself because of the traffic.
And now I am not speaking to you without a lawyer.
Okay, listen to me. I'm going to break your window if you don't let me in.
You call me a Nazi?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you calling me a Nazi?
Because you're acting like one.
How am I acting like a Nazi doing my job? Get your ID handy? Do you have your ID? Because let me explain something to you.
Stop you.
This is your ID, sir.
I'm in my own garage with my property.
Government operations.
It is called obstruction.
Obstruction from standing in my garage.
I'm asking.
Police officer, you'll also get arrested for that. Okay? Do you have a driver's license or ID?
I choose not to provide you with my information. I'm exercising my rights and not to, officer.
Well, you're right.
I'm not doing anything wrong.
I'm just telling you, you're guns, and I know what you're doing exactly. But I tell you, you don't have a right. I'm letting you, trying to identify who you are.
Have I done anything wrong, officer?
I don't know who you are.
Have I done anything wrong?
I just told you. We're getting multiple calls,
okay.
So I have every reason to be here.
Okay.
So what you're doing is trying to do, make a little YouTube video, trying to get some attention. That is fine. I'm not violating your rights, but I will. I'm telling you, if you don't identify to me, you will be going to jail.
I've spoken with Doug.
But if you don't identify the police officer, that is what's going to get you arrested.
Can I give you...
What you're going to go to jail for is you probably identify a police officer. And that's a completely different charge. So you better think about what you're doing. I'm asking you politely, okay? I'm going to give you a couple of seconds to hopefully... I understand what you're trying to do.
My rights...
But you are refusing to identify yourself to us?
Yes, sir.
You won't show us your ID?
I will not.
Okay. On this.
Yeah, I understand.
You want to play the game, we can play too.
Well, it's not a game.
Well, I wouldn't see why you wouldn't want to identify yourself.
Because I have no reason to. I mean, I have nothing to hide, but
you make a report
in the game.
You make a report on every instance that we go on,
Sure.
So we're going to take her name. Going to provide it to us. We ask for your name so we can identify who we're talking to. It's not because
okay. That's fine, but do I legally do I provide my under what statute?
Do you have an ID?
Yes, I do have an ID.
Okay, can you give me your ID, please?
Do I legally have to? I talked to my lawyer earlier.
Okay.
Because
and there is a logo that appears on the screen. According to another YouTube, very brief video, do you have to show your ID to police in California? Under the phrase question rack, and this was in September of this year, some states have what are called stop and identify statutes that require someone suspected of criminal activity to provide identification to police, making a refusal a crime. California has no such statute. So if you refuse to provide an ID while police are detaining you, they can't arrest you for just refusing. So there's some really interesting audio and videos on YouTube. They're videos, of course, but they're also audio accessible about your rights in terms of whether you have to identify yourself to the police in terms of the actual law. Of course, in police states, it's often not the law, but how police treat you that matters, particularly if you're poor, don't have good resources, aren't with friends, don't have anybody with a video that's keeping an eye on such things and so forth. They don't have your phone available, and your phone theoretically can, of course, be confiscated. But in any case, I did find something that's 3 years old, which talks about stop and identify statutes in different states. And it shows you the states where these are, at least at that time, they say currently in force. Montana, North Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and a bunch of states to the east of the Mississippi River, but not all of them, just a scattered number of states. Mississippi, interestingly enough, is isn't one of them. Nor is California, and that's the point. There's some interesting things that are mentioned on this website. These stop and identify statutes are laws in the United States that authorize the police to detain persons and request such persons to identify themselves and arrest them if they do not. But that's not the case in California, as I understand it from even more recent, again, blurbs on YouTube, the most reliable source, of course. The Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is that part of the Bill of Rights. It prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures and requires any warrant to be judicially and supported by probable cause. Court case Terry versus Ohio, 392 U.S. 1. It established that it is constitutionally permissible for police to temporarily detain a person based on reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed, hence the phrase reasonable suspicion. To conduct a search for weapons based on a reasonable belief that the person is... The question whether it is constitutionally permissible for the police to demand that any provide his or her name was considered by the U.S. Supreme Court in Hibble versus Sixth. A detainee provide his name was the question, whether it was permissible. All right, that's versus the Sixth Judicial District of Nevada, which held that the name disclosure violate the Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. It also held that because Hibble had no reasonable belief that his name would to incriminate him, the name disclosure did not violate the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. However, the court left open the possibility that the Fifth Amendment right might apply in situations where there was a reasonable belief that giving a name was incriminating. Accepted the Nevada Supreme Court's interpretation of the Nevada statute that police citizen encounters in the United States between citizens and police fall into three general categories: consensual, detention, or arrest. Identify laws pertain to detentions. Different obligations apply to drivers of motor vehicles who are generally required vehicle codes to present a driver's license to police upon request. Well, however, at any time police may approach a person, well, here's something from the website of edwardlawson.com about his famous Colander versus Lawson lawsuit way back in 1983. This was, however, posted in 2015. He looks kind of youthful, and it's done while he's driving a vehicle. But he made he insisted on taking to the highest court a case which resisted harassment by police, where he was repeatedly asked for his ID while walking around a neighborhood. He was an African-American guy. I'm going to play this in its entirety, and it's also available online. So check it out. And this has to do with actually law nationwide, although the stop and identify statutes apparently in more recent times in other states have at least taken priority in terms of having to say who you are. Apparently that's regarded as sufficient, stop and identify, but to actually show ID, I'm not aware that that is also required, particularly since it can become a form of self-incrimination, or it can be regarded as having to say anything when you can, by the Fifth Amendment, just remain silent, seems to be transgressing that rather traditional standard. And some traditions fall more difficulty than others. Some traditions actually are good traditions in terms of evading the modern-day police state or somehow resisting it.
Collar versus Lawson. That is the name of a United States Supreme Court case that was decided back in 1983. I'm the Lawson part of the title of that court case, Colander versus Lawson. Colander is the then chief of police for the city of San Diego, who was the other party in that particular lawsuit. And of course, San Diego is a fairly affluent community. The case started very innocently. First day that I flew into San Diego, I meet some people just by chance. They invite me to a party. I go to the party. Party finishes, and it's a beautiful San Diego evening, so I decide I'll walk home. Start walking home, get halfway there. It's late at night. It's quiet. You know, the crickets are probably chirping. All of a sudden, boom, a sheriff's car falls out of a tree. Sheriff comes out, and of course he's got, you know, guns sticking out of him, he's got antennas sticking out of him, all that sort of thing, and he wants to know, do I have any identification? And of course, I being the curious type, I asked him, well, you know, identification, why do I need identification? And he goes, you know, you can do it the hard way, you can do it the easy way. Conversation escalates, next thing I know, I am sitting in the county jail. I'm sitting in the county jail charged with a violation of 647E, which was the California ID law. And as I get further and further in this whole thing, what I discovered is that anytime that I was anywhere in San Diego where you had black people who were sitting around talking, or brown people were sitting around talking, or young people were talking, the conversation would take 3 minutes before it got around to everybody had a police ID story. Everybody had a police ID story, which seems to be like every other day of their life, they're being stopped for ID. And so I'm listening to all of this, and I'm saying, well, this just happened to me, and it's been happening to all you people. Why doesn't somebody do something about it? And that's, of course, when, you know, everybody starts looking down at their feet, and everybody starts going with the hemming and the hawing, and all the reasons that this sort of thing had been tolerated. I said to myself and to anyone else that would listen, it strikes me that this kind of conduct, in addition to being a tad inconvenient, is also unconstitutional. And so I took the case to court and did everything I could to win the case. I lost. Okay, so fine. You win some, you lose some. No sooner than I got out of jail for the first infraction of 647, the California ID law, then boom, another cop. Same question for ID, same interchange. And this one I didn't end up getting arrested for, but they held me for a certain number of minutes, hours, whatever. And this just kept on happening to me over and over and over again. Okay, so finally, about 15 times in 18 months, in all sorts of different configurations, I would be sitting in a restaurant. I would be, again, the inveterate pedestrian, which means I would be walking to one place or another. Sometimes I would be doing things as simple as I would be living in La Jolla, and I would like be going from like the front door to like the curb or something that's a very, and boom, they would hit me. So I took about 18 months to get 15 different occasions where they had stopped me for ID checks, 15 occasions where I had taken notes and got the policeman's badge number, written down a simple description of what was taking place, and I decided to take them all to court to challenge as to whether this kind of conduct was constitutional. What I started out with was the assumption that I could basically get some kind of legal assistance, because like anything that you do in this country that involves law involves money. And so if you don't have a whole bunch of money, which I did not at the time, what you're obliged to do is to come up with some kind of legal assistance. So I started off by getting a list of all the biggest law firms in La Jolla, in Del Mar, in San Diego, all the places where people have lots and lots of money and should have, you know, an interest in investing in or contributing something like this. And I went through this series of meetings where I'm going to see all these big-time lawyers and all these big-time offices with big-time secretaries and big-time mahogany desks. And, of course, all of them said some variation of no way. So the second thing I figured was, well, there's got to be all sorts of local organizations that should be like indignant and outraged at this violation of constitutional protocol. And so I went around to all the local, you know, who do-gooders who are supposed to do this sort of thing and told them, you know, why can't we just attack this thing or do something? And of course, they all said no. So I was then left with basically the civil rights organizations, things like the ACLU, National Lawyers Guild. And the interesting thing is that at the very beginning, they said, well, you know, we tend to do things that are real big, and this is real small. So that was a variation of no. So I had no other recourse but to walk over to the law library, open the first law book, and start studying the law so I could, in fact, do this myself, so I could represent myself, so I could proceed as a pro se or pro per litigant. And what essentially took place is over a period of approximately 8 years, representing myself, I first went to the state court challenging the constitutionality of the ID law, and I lost. I then went to what would be the district state court of appeal challenging the California ID law. I lost. I then went from the state system to the federal system. In other words, there's two different systems. There's state courts here, there are federal courts. Federal courts are big time. State courts are more or less small time. Went into federal court, district court, presented my case. I lost. Okay, then I went to the Circuit Court of Appeals. In this case, because it's California, something called the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals was really the first court that took an intelligent look at the whole proposal. And I won. And that was, I mean, I've been doing this now for 6 or 7 years, and that was the first time that I won. This is not an insignificant victory, because this particular law, this ID law, it was important for a number of reasons. For example, if you understand the Union of South Africa in the days where apartheid existed, you understand that one of the principal tools in segregating that community and oppressing the minority in that community was something called a pass law, which means that all the black people in South Africa had to have ID. They had to literally have an internal pass. And anytime they were anywhere, they had to be able to explain to the police authority what they were doing there, why they were doing whatever they were doing, and show them some kind of ID. We had in the United States, and in particularly in Southern California, the same kind of system. It was informal, that is to say, it wasn't written in law, but it was a practice. It was a sort of local Southern tradition. And this had been going on, and it had been like a black cloud over the day-to-day enjoyment of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for anyone you talk to who was black, who was brown, or who was young. And of course, Southern California, that's a lot of people. This particular victory in the Ninth Circuit, therefore, had enormous ramifications to an enormous part of the population, the black, the brown, the young of that particular community. And because it's the Ninth Circuit, it was not only Southern California, not only San Diego, not only La Jolla, not only Del Mar, not only Imperial Beach, but it was the nine states that make up the Ninth Circuit, which means California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Alaska, Hawaii, and maybe one or two more. It was the first time that the courts had really done something like this, you know, in anyone's recollection. All through our campaign, been very interested in doing two things at the same time. One is changing the law, and two, educating the public to the fact that this kind of work was being done, educating the public to the notion that as a private citizen, as a single individual, if you see something that is wrong, if you see government doing something wrong, if you see wherever it is you work doing something wrong, you can start yourself to try to change it. And this is a very important concept, because increasingly we see in society, everybody looks around, everybody sees all kinds of things that are bad, and they figure it's somebody else's job to change it, not mine. I mean, you know, people look at, they'll listen to the news on the radio or the television and say, why doesn't somebody do something about it? One of the most significant things for me was to get it into the mind of the public through media that whenever you ask the question, why doesn't somebody do something about this? The answer to that question is looking back at you in the mirror, to get people to believe in their own abilities to change and control their own lives. And so we had spent a lot of time and a lot of energy doing everything we could to get press on this. And of course, the media campaign had gone just about the same way that the law campaign. We just couldn't get anybody to do any kind of media at the beginning. We couldn't get any kind of legal assistance at the beginning. And once we got to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, It was the first legal victory, and then it just blew up the media thing, where nobody was writing anything on this before all of a sudden everybody was writing, you know, anything they could get their hands on. And that was a major, major change point in this campaign. What followed from there is, because we had won in the Ninth Circuit, the cops then appealed it. And they appealed it the only place that you can appeal it to, which is the United States Supreme Court. And nobody expected this thing to go to the Supreme Court. And so we pretty much figured it was, you know, over with. But to everybody's amazement, it was accepted by the United States Supreme Court. And this put into motion a major convergence of just about everybody who was anybody in the progressive, liberal, or civil rights community. One of the things that was very dramatic about this case was that it probably got more publicity, and it probably had more people participating as amicus curiae than perhaps any other case that was heard by the court that year. And that is a direct quote from whoever the Supreme Court reporter was for, I believe, CBS News. It was a curious undertaking, because the way that things work in the United States Supreme Court is it's in Washington, D.C. That's the only place it is. Everything that happens, you have to go to them. What they do is they have a period where you send them all kinds of briefs, all kinds of paper arguments. And then after they get the briefs, they have a period where they do oral arguments, where, you know, presumably you go there and you just basically say, you know, this is what I think is true, and they listen to you, and then they ask you questions, and then months later, they give you a decision. The most dramatic day in the Supreme Court is oral arguments. We'd done a bunch of work the weeks before oral arguments to get all of the press that we could interested, because again, at every intersection in this project, my interest was in the education of the public, in changing the public's mind, in infusing these kind of ideas into the public discourse and therefore public policy. I was always as interested in that as much as in changing the law. And so, like, we're working feverishly to get all the press interest we could get, to get all of the media interest we could get, and to do little maintenance things, like we had to actually physically figure out how to get to Washington, D.C. in oral arguments. We, of course, spent every dime we had on all of the press and all of the press packages and so forth. And it's a very good example of how if you start a great campaign, then stuff just happens when you need it. Miraculously, we're sitting there trying to figure out how to get to Washington, D.C. We get a phone call. It's ABC News. And the show is, I think, Good Morning America. And they wanted to know if we would be willing to do an interview with them on this, which is like a big deal. And we said, okay, fine. So automatically, plane ticket to Washington, D.C. So that was solved. The day of the oral arguments come, and I go downstairs in the elevator of the Mayfair Hotel. I needed a cab, so they got me a cab. I don't know what he thought I was doing, but he decided, since I told him I was going to the Supreme Court, that I obviously was part of the janitorial staff. And so the man delivers me to the Supreme Court, but to the servants' entrance. Now, this is, of course, a little piece of American history. I did not know that there was a servants' entrance in the Supreme Court. I should have figured that out, because then people certainly are not going to clean up behind themselves. So, you know, I should have figured that out, but I didn't know that prior to this. And so I get out of the cab. I start walking around the Supreme Court building, and you've seen pictures of the Supreme Court building. The front of it is this massive set of stairs that probably go up two or three stories, just stairs that just go up into the heavens, hopefully up to justice, although that's not always the case. And so I walk around in the front of the building, and I see the staircase, and about halfway up the staircase on the other side, I see like this huge mass of sort of like, it's sort of like reporters have like basically glommed into this great reporting mass with microphone booms sticking out and people with notepads and cameras everywhere. And I said to myself, well, I wonder, you know, who's being interviewed in the middle of all of this media thing stuff. And as like I barely got the words out of my mind's mouth, interesting concept, and I hear somebody in the crowd scream, there he is! And it turns out that all of the work that we had done sending out all the press releases to develop all that media interest. There it all was. And they just, like a white sale at Macy's, I mean, they started stampeding, running towards me. Everyone that you could think of, NBC, CBS, NBC, everybody there. And they're covering the case. And it was a major, major story. It affected a lot of people. We did oral arguments. And then, I think about maybe 4 months later, I'm in Berkeley, California, a stone's throw from UC Berkeley, which is where I'd done a lot of the law research, a place called Bolt Hall, which is the law school on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley. Phone rings, and it was CBS News. And they it woke me up, of course. And they asked me if I wanted to make a statement about the report this morning. And they were the first to inform me that the United States Supreme Court had just announced their decision in Colander versus Lawson, that we had won, that the courts had declared the practice of arbitrarily stopping Americans for no purpose than requesting identification when one is a pedestrian, when one is at liberty, when one is in public, it had been overturned. It had been ruled unconstitutional. And as such, that particular era in the long history of racial inequity had been brought to an end.
And just a few additional comments about Edward C. Lawson, who apparently died in 2011 of cancer, where there was no obituary to date. He died of pancreatic cancer. He was, according to Harvard Law University professor Lawrence Tribe, he commented during an appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show television, according to this a Wikipedia story, that this case, the Colander versus Lawson case, was the last time this U.S. Supreme Court decided favorably to a defendant in a civil rights case of this magnitude. The California Penal Code 647E that he was challenging was repealed by the California legislature in 2008, and that was the code that said every person who commits any of the following acts is guilty of disorderly conduct, specifically who loiters or wanders upon the streets from place to place without apparent reason or business, and who refuses to identify himself and to account for his presence when requested by any police officer to do so, if the surrounding circumstances are such as to indicate to a reasonable man that the public safety demands such identification. And that apparently was dumped. It was voided, however, in 1983, but it was not dumped until 2008. A tip of the hat to Edward Lawson, and a question as to why such a hero as this didn't even get an obituary. I guess it's what he did during his life that counts, not after his death. But let's take another musical break with Randy Rainbow. This is called Those Were the Good Old Days.
In a series of astonishing statements today, the president seemed to repeatedly take the Russian leader's side over that of
U.S. The Washington Post reports this afternoon that a woman is alleging Roy Moore...
President Trump squares up symbolically against Kim Jong-un, saying he's got a personal message.
Whenever I'm just too depressed to deal...
Another tumbling domino rippling through Hollywood.
And the quote-unquote fake news is much too real.
Things are about to get very, very weird.
I exercise the stress inside my brain and take a much-needed panic-induced medicated stroll down memory lane. I miss manageable scandal, the kind that I could handle without a lot of vodka and a Xanax haze. Good old innocent fluff, like that Watergate stuff. Yeah, those were the good old days. Business, Iran-Contra pardons, and presidential hard-ons, when political commotion felt like just a phase, like Barack's disrepute for the wrong colored suit. Those were the good old days. I pour me some tea and then turn on my CNN, at least while my patience will allow.
We have more breaking news.
Yeah, I can't. Remembering the simple things like tax fraud and whiskey rings, and wondering where's Anita Bryant now. I miss her. I miss Hurricane Katrina and Anthony Zawina and that darling girl Kim Davis when she came for gays. Wasn't that cute? Poor Dan Quayle's potatoes, John F. Kennedy's hoes, yeah. Those were the good old days. I gladly traded Jared Kush for just one more Bush from those Bush.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Old. I want to apologize to everybody.
Tonight with Donald Trump Jr. and his secret correspondence for months with WikiLeaks before the election.
I miss moderate decorum. Oh, I miss Rick Santorum before all the sleaze and Huckabees and dossiers. I miss Saddam Hussein. I miss Monica Stain. Those were the good old days. I stand in my shower stall, drinking more alcohol, and dream of the good times we forgot.
And
when hope was inside of us, and all that divided us was, did OJ do it or not? Even Mel Gibson seems charming again. I miss her. I miss him too. Aww. I miss Hillary's emailing. I might miss Sarah Palin. Back when all the greatest punchlines were Tina Fey's. Now the punchline's this putz, and the jokes are on us. I miss the good old days. I take a
And now I'm going to play part one of Know Your Rights, the Salinas Homeless Ordinance get-together protest speak-out that happened on November 11th, almost a little bit more than a week ago, I guess, or about a week ago, more or less. Not going to play it all. I'll probably be playing more of it on Sunday. It features some familiar voices for those of you who regularly listen to this show. I think Becky Johnson's in there. Wes White is certainly in there. Attorney Anthony Prince, who we haven't heard much from in the last year, but who has did a lot of work fighting the earlier Salinas anti-homeless laws, is joined this protest by phone. We're going to hear that too. It's about an anti-homeless law that essentially criminalizes having your possessions with you. Let's put it this way. I think it's setting up a campsite or a sleeping site during the day and at night in other places that the city doesn't want, such as City Hall, where the homeless folks set up protests under the direction of Wes White for half a year under an ordinance that was then changed by the city council, as it has now been changed again. Key part to this ordinance has to do, as I as I understand it, and I think I'm going to probably let those who are protesting against it describe it in more detail, but I believe it has to do with it. You have to pay to get your possessions back. And again, I've been following anti-homeless struggles in so many different cities, Berkeley, Sacramento somewhat, Salinas, Marina, Santa Cruz, Sacramento, I've mentioned before, I guess Redding for a time, Roseville, Fresno, Modesto. Let's let them speak for themselves, but the particulars of this ordinance are discussed in the course of this the audio of this video that you can also again catch on YouTube. It's under Know Your Rights, Salinas Homeless Ordinance, if you want to view it there. And that's probably going to be it for this particular edition, but who knows, I may pop in a surprise or two before the end. And if you want to get in touch with me, give me a call at 423-4833. That's the number to call if you want to be on the show, if you have information you think should be on the show, if you have some disputes about what you're hearing on the show, if you want to help volunteer for the organization HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, that I work with,
423-4833. Hello, hi. So my name is Wes White. I'm with the Salinas Monterey County Homeless Union. And today we asked for an audience to talk about the Know Your Rights seminar that we're doing for the Salinas Homeless Ordinance. It was passed on October 10th and goes into effect November 9th, which is tomorrow. So we have quite a few things that I wanted to introduce Rita real quick, and maybe she could talk for a little bit about whatever you want to talk about, and then we'll call Prince on the way as well, and you know, we can also edit. That's the beauty of video. So we can take a little bit of breath. I was thinking of actually going more last, but I just wanted to get it started because you folks are saying some great stuff. Honestly, so I video a lot of stuff and pass it out for the community as a gift to the community. And your stories are important too. And the conversation you were having was like, whoa, I got to capture this kind of stuff. So I think we are going to end up, if it's okay and all right, I'd like to be able to do introductions and just say like who you are and whatever your passion is in life.
Because he also records everything and he puts it all on YouTube. So people know, so it goes out in the different areas.
Right. Oh, and if you're going to talk, please almost kiss the mic, you know, you're just like 1 or 2 inches maybe. And basically at this point, we're just going to introduce ourselves, just say, hi, I'm me, and, you know, I don't know, whatever your favorite color is or something, or if you want to say something passionate, go ahead.
My name is Rita Acosta, and we actually came here to the park because we try to get the residents here from the park to know what's going to happen tomorrow with the ordinance. We wanted to inform them with the rules, what they can and cannot do. Once again, the city is going to allow people to camp from 7 to 7, so people are really happy about that. But the only thing is, they didn't tell them that they can't camp at the city parks, city streets, city property. So again, we come to where we're asking, where do they want the people to go? When we ask them, they're like, it's not our problem. Just, you can't be here. Or you could camp, but not here. You know, we say, you know, we're residents of Salinas, and we are still part of this community. It's not our fault that they choose to spend the means on other things. You know, their jobs as city council people, you know, that they're supposed to make decisions for the community. For the whole community, not just for the people, the communities that have money, so that includes the homeless community. You know, and we saw, you know, they act like if we wanted this. Like, you know, when we're little, we're like, you know, when I grow up, I think I'm gonna be homeless. Or you know what, tomorrow, I think I'm gonna be homeless. Nobody wanted this. Nobody wants to be homeless. Nobody has, oh my God, I'm homeless, and you know, yeah, it's great. It's not, it's really hard. The city seems to think it's easy for people to be homeless out here, sleeping outside. You know, they say we like it, and it costs nothing. That is such a lie. It costs us a lot. not just by money, but our pride, our dignity, you know, self-respect and everything. We go through a lot. I tell one of the ladies from city council, I'm like, on that personal time of the month, I invite you to come and stand in a tent with me so you can see what we go through as women being out here. There's nothing nice about it. And I'm not proud to say at one time I had to use a 5-gallon bucket to go to the restroom, but that's what we had. And if you all are up and down the streets here, if you go at night, nobody lets you use the restroom. And even more so, if you look homeless, they're not going to let you use it in the daytime. You know what I'm saying? We don't have the plague. We just don't have homes. You know, I'm a mother of 5. I have 14 grandkids. Yeah, I probably could go stay with my kids, but why am I going to interfere in their life? The city is supposed to provide for their people, for their community. The job of city council says you're supposed to make decisions for the community as a whole community, and they're not supposed to profit off of it. They might not profit individually, but the city of Salinas does profit off their decisions that they're making, because everything is for people that have money. If you don't have money, let's just say you don't exist. So we're not just here trying to live, we're also fighting to exist. You know, they can't they see us? Yeah, they do, but they choose not to. You know, everybody, you know, says, oh, we're getting a warming shelter. Great, yay. But we need something permanent for the people so they know that this is what we have this, not just at wintertime, you know. Bad enough as it is right now, they come to the park here every so many days. They take tents. They're not supposed to take people's property, and they still do. You know, so they're leaving people out here in the open with nothing over them. I mean, it might just be a tent, but that provides, keeps you out of the sun, it keeps the rain from hitting you, you know. So where is a safe community, healthy community? They're the ones who's not doing a safe community and keeping it healthy for us, because they're keeping us out here where, you know, people are dying, getting sick, and then they complain about us going to the hospital. You know, the homeless just keep coming to the hospital. They come and go, keep coming and going. Well, I wonder why that is. You know, we get sick, we have surgeries, we come back out here. So how are you able to heal? How are you supposed to rest? How are you supposed to get, you know, it's just one thing after another. And if you say you're hurt, you're homeless? Okay, I understand now. They think you're just trying to get pain pills, or you're trying to get, but that's not it. We're homeless and we hurt too. You know, live our life for one day, and I'm more than sure it'd be pretty hard. And even more so, it's just like how people in our community, what happened to respect each other? What happened to have love for the neighbor and stuff like that? And I would say that, you know, the Black Eyed Peas, that song, Where's the Love? I so much want to do a video from that, for those words, because we have that all here. We have that all here. There's discriminating against the poor. I just always say it's a war against the poor. Because what are they trying to do? They said we don't want to help ourselves. We are helping ourselves. We're providing homes for ourselves with a tent, with a makeshift tent or whatever. We're providing that for ourselves. The city isn't trying to work with us. I mean, I've drawn a tent community for them so they can see what we could do. You could do a transitional program from a campsite. Just have to have rules. In every place you have rules, things work. But they don't want to do it because it's not their idea. You know, like I said, we've had tents by the garden. The Flush program, we were co-chair with CSUMB. All of our dreams to make things keep on going and say, this is what the homeless did. We did this working together. We didn't get no credit for anything. You know, it became the college students did it. That's great. I always say, it doesn't matter who does it, long as it gets done. But you know, after a while, after they keep on stealing our ideas and change the name, it's like, hey, all those things that you're getting belongs to the community. We did the work for it. We made the block shine at that time, you know? We say, this is us, how we did it. It's really nice. And after when you ran us out, this is how you did it. Total mess. But then again, hey, always blame the homeless. When it's that time of the year for voting, you know, it's all that. We're going to blame the homeless for everything. Hi, Dan. You know, all the furniture you see everywhere, it's the homeless. They're the ones who bring it. They don't have homes. How are they bringing the furniture? People bring it in to Chinatown, so, you know, they don't have to pay that dump fee. You know, and they're like, well, we just want to give them a soft bed and everything. Really? So what about the rest of the trash? You know, it gets pretty hard to keep going and doing what we do. You know, it's not even, say, I lived here all my life, and it's hurt so much to know that it doesn't matter how long I've been here, that I raised my family here, that I worked here. I don't have money right now. I don't have a home, so and it means I'm not really worthy of being here for in Salinas. You know, and it hurts. I used to always say, yes, I live in Salinas. I'm proud to live in Salinas. Like, isn't it scary? No, there's crime everywhere. Now it's not the crime thing that bothers me. It's the way the city treats people. The way they treat people. I mean, 2015, my son was beat by the Salinas Police Department out here. We were at bingo. I called for help. You know, I need help for my son. Help isn't what came. I watched the Salinas Police beat my son nearly, I'm going to say, to death, you know. He just recently got out of jail. He was incarcerated from the day that they beat him up until just recently. All the time he did, every time he pleaded not guilty, they changed his attorney and started all over again. So I was like, my son's all, I'm so tired, I want to come home. I'm just like, you know, I didn't feel good that he was there, but I was just thinking, you know, people have to notice. Nobody noticed. Nobody cared. Nobody, you know, the police were saying that he was under influence of drugs. We just came out of bingo. They didn't say he was working. They didn't say that day he got his check. We went to bingo as a family. Nothing. They just, everything was negative. You know, and again, I have to say, Salinas just wants things to be their way. I mean, if we were really hurt in front of them, I don't think they'd stop to pick us up. You know, they wouldn't want us to bleed on there. They're like, can you wash that off when you're done? You know? I know, Wes, Dreds, all of us, Van, we've been out here homeless, but not helpless. We're still trying to help ourselves. We're not trying to take from anybody. We're not stealing or anything. You know, I just say, what is it going to take for City of Salinas to really do their job? You know, we went to a group yesterday. Mothers have, their kids have been murdered. I mean, you can't put a price on a child's life. You can't put a price on a human being's life. You know, but it doesn't seem to matter because we're poor. You know, I can't say it's a racial, it's just, you're poor. Right. You don't matter, you know. You don't got money to fit in with the Joneses and pass the mic and give it to somebody else because your story's not really important because there's no way for the city of Salinas to benefit from it. You know, so I would say, the ladies, you have a good idea, you want justice, you got to do it yourself. You know, if you say, you know, a woman's job is never done. We're the ones that, we're the backbone in the family, and if we want things to get done, we have to do it. You know, our husbands might work and do this and that, but we're the ones that hold everything together. When we speak, they hear us. You know, so we just, as women, we just got to keep working together, you know, and hopefully Salinas will see that, you know what, we have a lot of good, strong people here. They might not have money, but they're smart, you know. They could do something if they wanted to work with us, but they're not trying to, you know. It's be gone, don't exist, you know. They always say, you know, our first priority is to get rid of the homeless. They can't sweep us away, can't make us disappear, because we're going to be here no matter what. Irene, you want to say something?
Hi, my name's Irene Chavez. So, I've been homeless for years out here. I'm so tired of being out here. Year after year, don't get me wrong, you know, I try and try and try to look for resources here in Monterey County. And you know, they don't have any resources here that help or that I can stay consistent on talking to anybody about anything that I'm going through, because I don't matter, because I'm homeless. But today I live in Sherwood Park, and about the sweeps coming every 3 days, it takes really a toll on me, on my health, and frustrating, and not knowing if you're going to come back to your stuff or not when you leave. How am I supposed to have a job to make money to get off the streets if I got to worry about today and my stuff being taken for the next day? And 2011, my son was murdered. That itself was a tragedy. And living out here is a tragedy itself, too. And I've lived in Chinatown. I got out of Chinatown because I didn't want to be there anymore when bullets were flying here and there and you didn't know where they were coming from, why they were coming. They were just coming. So I moved to Sherwood, and I've been here at Sherwood off and on. You know, friends and family let me go and stay at their house a day or two. But I don't like to be a burden to nobody, so that's the reason why I'm still out here. It's been a long time since I had a job, but recently I've been putting applications in to see where, you know, somebody wants to hire me. Usually they don't want to hire nobody that's older or, you know, they're looking for young kids. So it's kind of hard for me right now. And, you know, I just want to get back to having a stability housing so I can get my life started. Because without that, I ain't going to be able to do anything, worrying about my stuff, worrying if I'm going to have a shower, you know, to be ready for work the next day. And it's not like I don't want to work. It's just hard to get started there. I have a lot to say. I'm angry, I'm upset, I'm frustrated because of situations of Dorothy's Place. You know, they discourage you, they give you something, they take it away. You know, it's just this community. How even the Salinas Police Department and Sheriff's Department, how they're supposed to be protect your community. Where is that at? There is not none of that. We know that. We have to protect ourselves. Why call them when they're not going to come till it's all done and over with?
Because we're not supposed to be.
And that's why every time I'm encountered with them, I'm like, you shouldn't be harassing me. You should be going looking for the murderers that murder people's kids.
That's right.
You know, because you should be worried about the homeless and where they sleep. Because you don't want them. You don't want us here. Well, where can we go? Can we go to your backyard? And no, we can't. Well, where do you want us to go? Actually, sometimes I feel like they just want to throw us away like trash. We're not trash. We are worth it, and we are someone. You know, and it just seems like. I'm pretty sure in their family, they have somebody just like us through their family line. And I don't know how they treat them, but the way they treat us is like not protect our community. You know, they're not for any of us. And like I said, there's a lot of people that look down like we're aliens or something, homeless people. We're not aliens. We are human too. And they're probably just one step away from being homeless themselves if they lose that job. That's all I gotta say.
Happy birthday to your baby.
Oh, yeah, and happy birthday to my son, Miguel. He turns 26 today. And after this, I got to go celebrate with him.
So I have our attorney Anthony Prance on the phone. He's a civil rights attorney, and he wanted to talk more about the homeless ordinance itself. Anthony, are you on the line?
Uh-oh.
Okay. There we
go.
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Okay, well, I'll try to keep it short, but I wanted to say a couple things. First of all, it's so good to hear Lula and Irene once again playing a leadership role. That is so important. I agree 100% with everything that they said about the situation, especially the emphasis on nobody's going to do anything for homeless people in Salinas. We're going to have to make a fight, and we haven't been making a fight for a long time, and the fruit of our labor is the fact that Salinas is at the head of the whole column now. The Salinas Homeless Union, people are looking to Salinas on how to organize, how to push back. That's the most important thing. And in Marysville, I want to report to you guys that in Marysville, Wes was contacted by a guy who was in a homeless camp that got broken up last year. We filed a lawsuit against the city of Marysville, and they formed a chapter of the homeless union up there. Yesterday, don't know if you guys heard, but in Sacramento, they had a lawsuit that went on for 8 years with a very similar anti-camping ordinance that they passed in Salinas. And unfortunately, it went to the jury, and the jury, and this is after 8 years of litigation, 8 years this case, they deliberated less than 3 hours and came back and made a decision for the city of Sacramento. And they found that the homeless were not being persecuted, that homeless were not being singled out by the same kind of ordinance that we're fighting in Salinas. So what they're going to do now, they realize now, I've been talking to them, that they can't expect to get justice just through the courts. They can't get justice just by begging and pleading and hoping the city will change its mind. The only way they're going to get a change is to organize, okay? And so they've been following what you guys are doing in Salinas. They've been following what's happening in Marysville. And it's time for us to come together. It's time for us to build, to expand this meeting all across California. And so I just want to point that out, that that's the most important thing. Now, I looked at this ordinance that they put on the table here. And this ordinance, once again, is unconstitutional on its face. They're trying to say that you have no right to your possessions unless they're just a small number of what they call personal items. They're saying that if you read this thing, and I don't have time to go into detail, but I'm going to prepare a detailed response to it. What they're essentially saying is that, okay, we're not going to criminalize the fact that you're putting your personal items on public property. We're not going to criminalize that. But what we will criminalize is if you fail to cooperate with the city employee who's going to tell you to get rid of that stuff. That's what they're saying. So that's just playing with words. They're just playing with words, okay? This ordinance is not only unconstitutional, but it means that they're going to confiscate property in a really arbitrary way. You know what I'm saying? And there, it's also giving power to any city employee. If you read it, it says any. It's against the law, a misdemeanor, for you to enter with any city employee. It doesn't say whether the city employee